Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to say happy, happy Christmas to you all. And we're presenting you with a program about a country that celebrates Christmas, because we've been there for the celebration.
Celebrate Christmas, really. They celebrate it really well.
Yeah. And first up is our dear friend Lydia Bastianich, who is one of the most celebration-bented persons.
You can imagine.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. Okay. Anyhow, her book is called Celebrate Like an Italian, and she knows just how to do that. It's always a pleasure talking to Lydia, who's a first name recognizable celebrity of books, TV, restaurants, everything, right, Lydia?
Yes, yes, I kind of jump from one to the other, and I love it all.
Yeah, but it's Lydia Mattachio Bastianich, and with her daughter, Tanya Bastianich Manuali, has written, is it your 11th, 12th book?
Yes, my 11th book.
11th book. This one is very special. I mean, I found it very special, and I have all of your books. It's called Lydia's Celebrate Like an Italian. And if there's anybody who is really meant to write a book like this, it's you. Not only are your recipes always, I'd say, infallible. You could say on the cover here, the publisher says foolproof recipes. But you have an idea about entertaining that you help people execute with this book. First of all, you love fetting, don't you?
I do. I mean, you know, I love the whole of being together with family and friends and enjoying life in through food. But you know, Anne, I get, like you do, you know, I get a lot of emails, a lot of calls, and Lydia, can you help me with the party? I need to give a party. How about, you know, I have a sport party, people coming over. I have a kid's birthday party. I have an engagement. And, you know, through years, it's my 11th book, I've been kind of thinking about it and collecting. And so finally, I decided this is the time to do a celebration book and help and kind of lead my fans into making a great party or a great dinner. And it is not that complicated.
You give tips throughout this book that takes the pain out of this entertaining business. Things that maybe nobody would ever think about. Give us some of those ideas that you cover in the book.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, the thought is that you're giving the party, and, you know, it's your flavors, it's most likely your venue, and you have to feel very comfortable and in charge right away, right off the bat. You know, start with, okay, I'm going to give this party, and then you organize it accordingly. Yes, you take in consideration your guests, and if they have some you know, food needs or drink needs. But having said that, for example, a bar, you know, yes, everybody, you know, libations kind of opening to a party. But you don't have to have a whole bar spread, you know, Mary drinks Tanqueray, John drinks cider. You know, what I recommend, and I have in this book about 20 recipes for great Italian drinks, aperitivos, and you choose one of them. For example, one of them is an Italian in Manhattan. I took a regular Manhattan, and what I did is, you know, a good rye, some sweet vermouth, and then I added amaro, the Italian amaro. That gives it a kind of a little bit tinge of bitterness to a great Manhattan. So what I'm saying is, this is a different Manhattan. People will be intrigued. Put all the what you need, the bottles of the three liquors that you need for this, all the accoutrements and the recipe, and have the guests make their own drink. One drink, not 20 drinks, one drink. And then you have, in addition to that, a great white and a great red and maybe a Prosecco if you want. But this takes the whole pressure out of, oh my God, the whole setting up the bar.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? The guest will be pleased because they'll learn something new and it's a new taste.
Well, that's great.
No, it's funny because we used to entertain a lot. We do it a lot less now than we used to, but we always set up a full bar, and it was always a real pain.
It was awful.
It was such a lot of work trying to figure out what everybody wanted when they wanted a second one.
Exactly, Peter. You know, it's your home, your party, and you know what? It's nice for them to learn a new drink. To you know, and of course, I'm always on the Italian flavor scheme. So an Italian party, you know, with an Italian aperitivo, it's beautiful. And you don't have to worry about anything else.
You know, maybe we should just explain a little bit. I mean, this whole concept of aperitivo is a big idea in Italy. I mean, they still have it.
Yes, you go around Italy, and there is, it kind of had a big revival, where you have, right after work, you know, like they have the happy hour here. In Italy, it's all about the aperitivo. And you have this kind of light aperitivos, not, you know, martinis or whatever, and proseccos, and you have things to nibble, which really are the restaurant, whatever, puts out things to eat, because, you know, drinking on an empty stomach is no good. So, which takes me to the next part of entertainment. I tell them, how can you entertain without cooking? The antipasto, the aperitivo, is the way. So if you can make a big spread just by the best ingredients, prosciutto, mortadella, salami, capocollo, big chunks of cheese. Don't cut the cheese. You know, have a cheese, have a knife there, have them cut it, mozzarella, then vegetables, you know, and not cooked vegetables. You can have the pickled onions, the artichokes, the roasted peppers, all of these vegetables spread out, and all you have to do is open the jars, put them out, so you have some fresh tomatoes, some fresh fruit, some dry fruit, and some crunchy bread, and you can see this could be a beautiful spread for 10. You can make it for 10, for 20, for 30 people. And you have your aperitivo, your drink, and all of this, and you have a party without even cooked.
Now, do you attend to details, though, in all these? You do a variety of parties, but you think about details even down to if you're going to have these wonderful olives that you make with the rosemary and orange peel. You have a bowl for the pits.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I see it always when I go to a party, even myself, and I'm there holding the pit. Okay,
yes,
I'm looking.
Exactly. I've been there. I mean, that's awful.
You're looking.
Well,
for
that's important. You know, another tip that I always say, I would say, okay, so now you have your antipasto, is that a dinner, let's say that you have a sit-down dinner, people stand up and have a buffet antipasto.
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing, when you have them sit down, let's say you do a pasta. Baked pasta is your friend when you're doing parties. You know, the oven is your friend. You know, as far as meats, roasting, braisings are your friend. These are things that you can do in advance, and then serve. So let's say that you have the baked pasta. And let's say that you have baked shells, which is not a big deal to make. But remember, don't put it all in one casserole. Make it in three casseroles.
Yes, I love that.
So when you're ready to serve, you put it on the table on coasters with a nice serving spoon and let everybody help themselves and take as much as they like. Saves you the serving, the confusion. You have it spread around the table so people don't have to wait until that end of the table finishes, and so on. The same for the main course. When you have, if you have, let's say that you have a roast prime rib or whatever, and you slice it, three plates, vegetables, divide them again, two, three plates, divide everything, put it on the table, make sure you put serving utensils on each one of those platters, and then the people, and it's fun. And it's fun because people kind of work into it themselves and take as much as they like. So those little things that make a big difference.
You know, the serving utensil thing is something that bothers me even in restaurants. If you're going with a group and you're going to share and they don't give you any serving utensils.
Exactly. That's a small thing like that makes a world of difference. And then your table comes alive. And you're the hostess. You can sit down and enjoy instead of worrying about serving or passing it around or whatever.
Yeah, now you spell this out in this book because you what you can prepare, how soon, how early, when to pull it out. Some things are good for room temperature. Some have to be chilled. Some have to be hot. You spell it out with every single dish. It's
right,
wonderful.
Right, right. You know, mixing some of those things so you don't have to depend only on your stove and your oven. You know, if you have some room temperature, you know, if you roast, let's say, acorn squash, you roast it, and, you know, I like to put some toasted walnuts on top of it, maybe a drizzle of balsamic vinegar. Those are perfectly fine at room temperature. Mm-hmm. If you have a steamed leek salad, you know.
I'm going to do that one, by the way. That's one I've not done. And, you know, I adore your salads. I'm always stealing your ideas for salad.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so you can leave it at room temperature. You know, this the leek, walnut, and gorgonzola salad.
That's
it's a delicious salad. So, you know, if you don't like the gorgonzola, you can omit. I always also tell my viewers, my followers, you can take my recipe and moderate it, change it. You know, if you don't like blue cheese, you might like cheddar cheese. Do it, yeah. You know. The freedom of taking my recipes and making them your own.
Now, I love some of the situations that you've set up in your book, like what do you do when the in-laws are meeting for the first time? I love that.
Yes, yes.
I've been there.
Well, you know, absolutely. So, you know, those are social as possible. You don't want to seclude yourself in the kitchen. So, you know, things that you could do together, like an antipasto where you can share and talk and drink. Then you sit down, I think, you know, like a soup instead of a soup, and you just ladle it, everybody's seated, you bring the tureen to the table, and you pour it. And then, of course, a braised meat, you know, or a roast. It's the best. You kind of slice it, and you can kind of, you know, show your heritage, especially if, like, let's say, two different cultures are the bride and the groom are different cultures. You know, you're mm-hmm. Italian, you do your Italian and you show. But, you know, also use respect, whatever the ethnicity is, have something of their ethnicity just to say welcome, you know, welcome part of our table. That shows kind of respect without even saying a word. You put the food there, and they will right away feel much more comfortable.
I think my mother must have read.
Why?
The first time you met her, I'm sure she made Yorkshire pudding.
There you go. Yeah, you have to appreciate, you know, the other. You have to welcome them in the house. Let's say.
Remember that my big fat Greek wedding that the waspy. To be in-laws came with the bun cake.
Yeah.
And nobody,
the Greeks didn't get it, but yeah. They enjoyed it.
Yeah, they did.
Put a bouquet of flour in the center of the cake.
Yeah.
They didn't know what it was, did they?
Yeah.
Now, you have a ritual of your own for entertaining, involving moving people around from your kitchen to the table and back. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, I do it, especially when I have at home, I do this antipasto stand-up buffet, everybody takes, I have a little plate, I have it all spread out, and I go, you know, beyond also the cold cuts and the cheese, I do salads like shrimp and beans, and I give you all these recipes here, or a nice beet salad, you know, a nice diversity, lots of vegetables I like, and salads. And then everybody sits down, and usually, you know, again, either a pasta or a soup, and family style. I usually like family style. I put it on the table, just like I said, with the serving, and let everybody help themselves. Then dessert, I do again buffet style. I clean up where I had the antipasto, and put the spread of the different desserts and all the different decorations, whipped cream, toasted nuts, chestnut puree, whatever the season is, mm-hmm. I put it all out. And again, the display the desserts, I even cut a few first slices, not too big, because I want people to taste everything. And then let them come up and let them make their own, build their own dessert platter.
And then they won't be like Anne. They won't be able to say, I don't eat dessert.
Yeah. Well, but you know, I always do is some fruit, some fresh fruit at the end. You know, especially around the holidays, the clementines, the citrus family, the good digestive, the blood oranges, and those people that, you know, just want fruit, they have everything there. So it's not, you know, you don't make a scene about, oh, I don't want this dessert or that. It's there. You take what you like. And then they come back to the table. And, again, the coffee, I have somebody of the family usually, because we have the espresso machine, on guard at the espresso machine. Whoever wants the espresso either comes and gets it or given, or there's a water for tea and so on. And it gets kind of everybody really involved and socializing.
Well, I mean, I think this is, it's a guide to entertaining that just, I think it's a wonderful, it makes you at ease about tackling and entertaining, which is, you know, people get really scared about it, and this takes away that anxiety. And you cover so many different events. You have an Italian-American wedding, you have ringing in the New Year, you have an Italian picnic, and then you have, in addition to all of those tips and setting the table, you have really some of your wonderful recipes, which I can attest to the fact that they are so thoroughly tested, is they were absolutely on the mark, and I trust your recipes, Lydia.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you. Yes, I focus on the people out there, and I really want them to make these things. So when I test a recipe, I streamline it in a sense that it still has a lot of flavor, and there are certain important steps that they should do, but that it's not so complicated, you know, that you don't need 300 ingredients to make one sauce or something. It's not always necessary. You can achieve good flavor. What is very important is that the ingredients that you buy are the best. You know, I like them when they're in season, and so on. So I go through all of those kind of directions of what makes a good meal and a good recipe. But the recipes are very doable and straightforward. Well, I get, and I really love it. And I'll repeat it when they tell me, Lydia, you empower me to cook, and
yes,
that's a great feeling on my part.
But you do. That's a huge asset you have here.
Yeah.
And your hands are so recognizable too.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say, "Oh, I can't boil water," and I says, "I don't buy that."
Yeah.
Everybody can do something with food. Food
right.
is part of us, you know. You're born, you're handling food, you're eating, so, you know, I don't buy that you can't. Everybody can cook something.
Well, again, it's Lydia's Celebrate Like an Italian, and it's a must-have book, especially this time of year for the holidays, and throughout the year. And the photography, as with all your books, the photography is extraordinary, Lydia.
Yes, the photography, you know, because, again, I don't give my recipes to a stylist. I go in the studio. It's Tanya, myself, and Amy Stevenson. There's a trio of us. We go in the studio, which are the photogenic recipes, the ones that they should see, and maybe the ones that need more to be shown to get to that end. But we do it. We do it there. So everything, all those photos, is food that I cooked. Nobody else cooked.
And then if you're not convinced that she's having a good time and that you can trust her to have a good time, there's Lydia with a big bowl on her head on the backpack.
you know, that was kind of a fun. That was a pasta salad.
That's,
you know,
what
which
I thought.
Everybody loves, and it's nice. And so we were finished that photograph shoot, and I was so happy. I says, okay, my grandmother used to walk like that when she used to go, you know, in the town we had a communal oven.
Yes.
And it would be lit twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so the women of the town all knew the days and when they wanted to bake the bread. And my grandmother would knead the bread, put it on a board, and put it on top of her head like that to carry it to the communal oven. So I said, I'll do like my grandmother here,
aww,
carry.
That's what that is. That's cute. Yeah, we're getting one of those in Pittsburgh in Braddock, you know, with the new, new restaurant, Superior Motors, you know. They're gonna do a communal oven. I don't know who's gonna use it, but I thought that was neat, yeah.
Yeah. No, I love the real oven, the wooden oven. Uh-huh. But it's, you know, in the big cities now, it's a problem. It's a problem with the exhausting of the fumes and all of that, the pollution. So,
anyhow, well, this is another winner, Lydia Bastianich, and I wanted to ask you, have you been to that new operation in Bologna, which is I think it's Bologna.
Yes, FICO.
What's it called?
FICO.
Is it? It's called the Disney World of Italian food.
Well, that's the description, but FICO means Fattoria Italiana. But it's about the different food producers all over Italy and cheese making and all of that, and they have it. It's a large Disney World where you can go and taste the different productions and foods from all over Italy. And I have not been yet, but Joe has been and my son-in-law has been, and they loved it. So I'm looking forward. In the spring, I'm going
to
go.
Oh, you're going to go in spring. Well, yeah. We have to go, too, I guess. It seems like it's so big, though. I don't know how you organize it. We've never been to Disney World.
Well, but, you know, I'm sure they have those golf carts or whatever that actually take you around. Because,
well, anyhow, maybe we'll meet you there in Bologna.
Okay. You never know. Yeah. You know, I go to Italy a few times a year.
Yes,
so.
Good for you. Well, good to talk to you again, Lydia.
And
take
Pete,
care.
Grazie mille. Thank you
grazie a lei.
Oh, prego. and get celebrating.
Okay. That's what we want to do. Thanks, Lydia.
Ciao.
Ciao.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I'm going to hand over to Anne in just a second to introduce our next guest, but you kind of get an idea of the kind of personality he is when you know that his part of his URL, his name and his URL is the Tuscan Gun. now, who is this man and exactly what does he do, love?
Well, this is Gabriella Corcos, and he, with Debbie Mazur, who everybody knows, I'm sure, wrote a book called Tuscan, Super Tuscan, and in it you'll find all these heritage recipes from Tuscany, as well as what they term simple pleasures, which seems to be what most people are talking about. I'm so thrilled to be talking to Gabriele Corcos, who wrote a book with his wife, Debbie Mazur, who you must undoubtedly know. She's a very successful and very effective actress. The book is called Super Tuscan. And Gabriele, you grew up in Fiesole, just outside of Firenze, Florence, right?
Yes. Hi. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's fun for us.
Yeah, I miss it so much. Yeah. I am from. I was born in Florence, and then, but then I was raised in a small farm that my grandfather gifted my parents for their wedding, up in the hills, right above Florence, in a town called Fiesole, an Etruscan town, which is very, very nice. Very quiet, but still, you know, close enough to the city. So I got the best of both worlds. I got to live in the country and enjoy, you know, the art and the architecture and the history of Florence. So, yeah, I'm kind of like spoiled that way. But I miss it.
Well, how often do you get back?
If I am lucky, I would say 2-3 times a year.
That's great.
Otherwise, like once. It has been times where I went a little less than that. It depends, you know. I'm raising a family. I'm working on my career here. It's really busy living in New York. It's hard to unplug.
It is. It really is.
Yeah. Why did you move? We didn't ask you that before we came on the air.
I fell in love with Deborah in the hot summer of 2001.
Okay. All right. Well, I thought.
Then I actually went to Los Angeles.
Yes.
I didn't come straight here.
Well, we were going to do Cherchez La Femme, and we sort of knew that. but we wanted our listeners to know there was a romantic side to the story.
Always.
We're talking about this book. I mean, it is Italian cooking, but it's Italian cooking through the filter of your Tuscan eyes and background, but also influenced by your experiences for, was it 15 years? How many years have you been in the United States?
I've been here 16. Yeah,
16
I'm going
years.
On my 17. Yeah.
And also, particularly, you spent some time in Los Angeles, and California cuisine sneaks into some of these recipes too. Tell us what some of the influences are on your cooking style.
Oh my gosh. Well, I draw the heritage and the core, obviously, from my, you know, comes from my upbringing in the farm. So I learned from my grandmother, the wives of the farmers, and my mom. And then, you know, long story short, all of a sudden I am in Los Angeles. And I am also growing a family because, you know, Deborah got pregnant fairly fast. and the idea was really to maintain alive, really, what I always thought it was the power of food while I was growing up, which is to bring people around the table and then create that sort of safe zone that is conducive to conversation, memories, love in general, and I think is really, really important. While I was living in Los Angeles, I actually found the California cuisine fairly close to what we call the Mediterranean diet.
Yes.
Even if I, in the years that I was there, I didn't think that the Italian cuisine was really represented for what it truly is, meaning that if you wanted to have, and to a degree it's still like that in Los Angeles, if you want to enjoy something that resembles extremely well Italian food, you need to spend a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
And really? that is not the core of where I come from. Yes, we do have a high cuisine and expensive restaurants in Italy, but for the most part, we thrive on peasant recipes, recycling ingredients. Slow food to us has always been the way we, you know, the movement didn't exist, but that's really the way that every village and every city thrived historically in Italy. So when I was there, that's kind of like when I realized that my way of cooking was to a degree a little closer to the needs of regular people, of, you know, I call them users, but, you know, just for the sake of understanding. And that's why I started writing my recipes, and eventually with Deborah we decided to just have fun with it and try to post it on YouTube to see if our way was a good one, and it worked. We also got very lucky. That was the very beginning of the food celebrities, food becoming mainstream, also in the, you know,
but now you are a chef.
Level.
You are a chef. You are a chef.
My job, yes. Uh-huh. But by definition of the work that I do, because I get paid to develop recipes, consult with restaurants, I work with companies in the food industry, but I consider myself much more of an ambassador and a creative when it comes to the Italian experiencing food and lifestyle in general. The funny thing is that I did create a show where, because I was broke, I ended up being the star. I was also the one cooking.
Does Debbie cook too?
Yes. Well, she inspires me. I have now shot myself in the foot, and I am the cook of the house. Not just because I cook better than her, because there are things that she does, you know, as good as I do. I think because I have more fun, I'm a little quicker, a little bit more practical, and I just love my role of preserving that aspect of, you know, bringing the girls downstairs for dinner. You know, especially now that they're growing. You know, when they were a kid, it was so much easier. You put them on a high chair and you tell them, look, you know, Papa cooks for you. So, you know, they're 15 and you want to make sure it's like, hey, just come home and spend 2 hours cooking. Come on, it's dinner time. So, and then, you know, and then we moved to New York. And New York was very, very different. It was a much needed change because at least finally now I'm leaving the seasons. I lived in LA for 11 years. And I lived through the drought in Los Angeles and the heat waves, and it was absolutely incredible. You know, in the very beginning, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh my gosh, it's always spring and summer here. And after a decade, you're like, all right, you know, where's the thunders? Where's the snow? Where's the, you know, how can I cook a stew at Christmas if it's, you know, 100 degrees? Mm-hmm. So now we do enjoy, you know, real cabbage in wintertime, more potatoes, the seasonality of it all, even if, you know, the world is shrinking. So if you're looking for strawberries in December, you still can find them. I try to hit farmers markets when it comes to vegetables more than, you know, regular markets. So at least I kind of like go with whatever comes down from the farms. I would say mainly upstate New York farms. Uh-huh. And now that the book is out, you know, it's kind of like a testament of really realizing that my life here has made me fall in love with a few recipes that you guys have, like the chowder. I am a gigantic chowder.
Oh, yeah, you
fan.
Said that. You were in love with chowder.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in a kosher kitchen. My father was a kosher Jew, and my mother kind of, like, respected his wishes of not having swine or shellfish in the house. So my upbringing, you know, I had to sneak out every time I wanted to eat something that was, you know, vaguely traditional cuisine until I got my first motorcycle when I was 14. And now, you know, once you can leave the farm and go out and eat with your friends, then you can eat whatever you want. But, yeah, I went in the Northeast, and I just fell in love with really good chowder. But I wanted to give it my own spin because, ultimately, I don't like copying recipes or studying other people's recipes. I like to cook in my head. I like to think about, oh, well, you know, if I was to make chowder, how would I make it? What ingredients would I choose? So, you know, obviously, I kind of like went through the scheme of the base of the chowder, the roux, the you know, the little flour, the butterness of it. But then I went mussels instead of clams. I used guanciale instead of bacon. And I kind of like tried to bring it home. I tried to own it a little bit to find myself into it. And that's kind of like what Super Tuscan is. The same that they, you know, the same concept that they applied to wines many, many years ago when people started mixing traditional Chianti grapes and grapes that were not allowed, quote unquote, that made a lot of producers lose their, you know, Chianti name on the label because you need to go by those kind of rules in order to be able to call your wine Chianti. And ultimately, I think that when it comes to, you know, food is almost an expression of art. People keep on getting better at it. So I actually, you know, I am in awe of the courage that those producers had to say, you know what, our wines will sell regardless. Our wines will be delicious regardless. We don't mind not being called Chianti. We'll do something different. And some of them are putting out products that are absolutely fantastic. So I hope that my book is received as well. That's really it. You know, it's a mix. It's more of a global.
You wrote another book before this. It was very well received, called Extra Virgin.
Yes, and that is still selling, and I'm extremely proud of it. That truly was the love letter that I had started writing to my daughter and my wife when my wife told me that she was pregnant.
Okay.
That's the moment where I started collecting all my recipes and writing down the basic memories. And then eventually, when the daughter was born, all those pages turned into those web episodes, and then eventually found their way, like almost a decade later, into a real book, which was for us a fantastic project. I mean, that book really tells the story of who we are. This new one, Super Tuscan, is I wouldn't say less personal, but we kind of like assume that, you know, we talk to our fan base, and obviously, you know, whoever doesn't know us that wants to try the book. But for the most part, we have a lot of loyal readers and eaters. And then we kind of like they assume that they know who we are and how we got to this second book. Obviously, it's a book that stands alone. If you want to read it without knowing anything about the first one, that there's enough information to, you know, generate the context in which you can enjoy it. But it is actually a very nice second volume, even if it's a different publisher. It really goes with the first one. You know, the names are fantastic together. I keep them in the library now here, you know, close to my desk together. I'm so proud of it. You know, Extra Virgin, Super Toscan. I wonder what the next name will be. I know at least the culinary direction that I am going. I'm broadening my spectrum. And instead of, you know, for a long time, I thought of diving even deeper in the regional cuisine. But as much as I am very passionate about it, I find it reductive for the reader because then, you know, if you try to do heritage Tuscany, you have to do a lot of game, a lot of hunting, a lot of products that you will never be able to find here, like cold, specialty cold cuts or sometimes even illegal cheeses. So I am embracing actually the fact that Italy was such a fantastic position in the Mediterranean where we had so many historical influences. And because I sailed a lot because my father was a sailor, I have learned, you know, a lot about coastal foods and then Moroccan influences in Italy and then French influences. So I'm now playing with couscous and different kind of meatballs and a lot of vegetables and trying to find something different where obviously the hand is still Tuscan. Uh-huh. You know, the scale is in the hand and then the understanding of the ingredients is the same. But where the flavors are a little bit of a broader spectrum.
Yeah, I get
even
that.
If I loved, yeah. You know, even if I still love to cook boar and you know, game anytime I can.
Gabrielle, why is it, this is a fundamental question, we've sort of picked around it a little bit, but what is it that makes Tuscany so special? I mean, to Italians and to visitors. I mean, I say to people who are planning to go to Florence, the most likely people you're going to meet in the street are your next door neighbors.
Yeah,
but why? I mean, Tuscany from under the Tuscan sun, from over on the coast where they make that wonderful wine called Sassicaia. There are so many different parts of Tuscany, and. And yet they sort of all hold together, and they sort of weave a magic that you feel when you get there.
Well, as far as I am concerned, it is something that I probably understood better once I left Tuscany behind. You know, you never know how good you have it until you're without something, being a relationship or the place where you come from or anything else. I found myself in Los Angeles. Kind of like lonely in the terms of the historical presence, but also the simplicity that I believe is really at the core of life.
I mean, Los Angeles is contrary. Yeah. Los Angeles is, I mean, I really could never live in Los Angeles. I could.
Oh, well, you know, I was in love, so I really wasn't looking at the city as anything else but the place where I was, about to be a father and getting married and madly in love. So, but yes, I can tell you that by the time that we were leaving about 6 or 7 years ago, after having lived there for 11 years, I was so ready to get the hell out of there. I found it extremely superficial, and I am very, very naive. I believe in people a little too much, and I was keeping getting caught into relationships that I thought were real, and they kind of like almost never were. So I kept on falling for it because I'm genuine, you know. I'm like, yeah, sure. And then all of a sudden you realize that, they're really skimming the cream on top of this, you know, gigantic foam that the entertainment business is over there. But again, I really didn't care. I was in love. I created myself an opportunity in that industry, which is fantastic because I've done it all on my own. My wife obviously helped me. She's supported me and she's sold it with me. She's part of the creative process, and we do everything together. So I do realize that I was very, very lucky. But going back to the question, yes, I think that the power of Tuscany is the ability of appreciating the simple things, being able to just sit down, take a breather, and then feel that ultimately you're in a beautiful place and you don't need much else. that actually goes really against the American model, which is it's never enough, more, consume, use, earn, spend, move forward, more future and less history, which is also the opposite problem that Florence has. Florence these days only has history to offer and hospitality.
Oh, yeah, wow.
That's why it's a notion of tourism. There's a lack of new businesses. Young people are, leaving the town because the town is not allowing them. There is no room for them in the center. They don't get discovered in the outskirts. It's really tough.
Yeah.
But that has been the problem with historical cities in Europe, especially now that the world is kind of like getting overpopulated. That is just how it is. Mm-hmm. It's the same with Venice. Venice is impossible.
You can't even get a decent restaurant meal in Venice.
but in general, my definition of vacation is very different. Yeah, I love art and I love looking around and taking pictures, but I could never find a relaxing moment into saying, "Oh, let's go for a vacation in Rome in summertime or Venice in summertime." Like if I,
you can go to Venice in the winter, but it's really
exactly.
unpleasant
yeah.
in terms of
the
weather.
Very, very different. It's very Venice in the winter is very Jack the Ripper. It's very Londonish. The canals are very quiet. The fog is always up in the morning. You hear noises. You don't know where they're coming from. All the buildings are built, for the most part, with a lot of wood, so the screeching and noises and the smell, it's just fantastic. Summertime is just hot and overpopulated and overpriced and overhyped and just too busy for me, so.
Well, when you're promoting this book, are you promoting a lifestyle then as opposed to specific recipes?
For the most part, yes. Obviously, those are recipes that I happily share, but my favorite idea is to think that people are going to use that book not to learn how to become better cooks, but to bring people together and eat.
Right.
It's the same experience, but lived in a different way. I always cooked. I never intended making cooking, a career out of cooking. Now it is, because that's what happened. But it is still more important for me to make sure that, I do have a skill that allows me to show people how much I care for them.
I see.
And that, to me, what cooking is, really. Just the power is there. And that's why I always tell people, it's like, look, the food and the fresh ingredients are one thing, but everything tastes better if you tell a story with it, if you put it into context, if you allow people to connect with what they have in front of you. Not necessarily the story of the little animal or how I raised the vegetable, but even family memories or just the simplest conversation that can just, spark at the table when people are happy eating good stuff. That is my payback. But obviously we need to earn and make money these days, so...
Yeah.
So. That is my emotional attachment to the work that I do. When it comes to, the earned work, yes, ultimately I am a chef. I get paid to develop recipes and write books and do TV shows. But I am trying to expand. For example, my dream is really not a restaurant in Manhattan. I really am trying to work hard to find financing to buy a small property in Italy and build my kitchen in Tuscany.
Uh-huh.
Because I miss I really miss my land, and I receive so many requests of people that would love to study with me or work with, spend time in the kitchen with me, and I don't have the right environment.
So you want to have a cooking school in Tuscany.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that I really, I have my eyes on a couple of properties. We'll see what happens.
Well, let us know, and meanwhile, people can experience some of this warmth that you exude in this book through the recipes and through your the way you approach the gathering of people around something as important as food. Again, it's Gabriele Corcos and his wife, Debbie Mazar, and it's called Super Tuscan, Heritage Recipes and Simple Pleasures from Our Kitchen to Your Table. And good luck with this book. Gabriele.
Oh, thank you so much.
And let us know when you have your cooking school running, and we can talk about that some more, too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I hope it happens in a year or so. We're very close.
Oh,
so,
that's good, good, good. Well,
yes.
So don't forget to tell us.
No, I won't.
Thank you.
I'll reach out. Thank you so much
thank
for having
you, Gabriele.
Me.
Ciao, ciao.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we certainly can't end a program on Italy without injecting a little bit about wine and olive oil. And we found a fascinating small producer in the, region of Umbria. Who's got a really interesting story to tell. Here's Lorenzo De Monaco.
Now, every time I sip this wonderful Italian wine, I get nostalgic and homesick. And now talking to Lorenzo De Monaco, I think I'm also homesick. Lorenzo, thanks for talking to us about your wonderful wine. I was a little confused about the name of it, La Segreto, because there is a wine made in Sicily that's called La Segreto. Do you know that?
I sure do. Yes, they're very well known. It's by company. It's by company called Planeta or winery called
Planeta. Yeah, a good friend. Yes.
Yeah. So it's the difference is that our azienda name, our Agricola La Segreta, is the company basically. But when we make wines that have different names, clearly, you know.
Yes.
The interesting thing is Alessio told us that the La Segreta in his wine portfolio has absolutely nothing to do with a secret. It just happens to be where they get the grapes for the particular wines, both red and white, that they put La Segreta on as a name.
Right, I think it's the plot, the vineyard plot.
Yes.
I think
exactly.
That's the place there, right?
It's not a secret.
In our case, it started off differently because the way we're located, and if you ever visit us. It's quite secluded and it's hard to find to the point that if you were to put this in your car navigation, you would never get here. So the only way to get here is by getting directions. That's how it became the secret. So
I see. Anyhow, we're thoroughly enjoying your wine. You have an interesting background. You go back to when you and your wife, where you say you were born in Switzerland, right?
That's right. As a yes, and then
and you went to college in the United States.
That's correct. Yes, Boston.
Your wife is American.
She is.
Yes, and you had a cycle touring operation before going into the wine business. Now, that's unusual, isn't it?
It's the twists and turns of life. One never knows what the next bend brings. This was something we cultivated many, many years ago, more than 20 years ago, and we brought it into existence and into fruition over the last probably 10 years by devoting ourselves and our family to the project and to the idea and to the estate and to the hospitality part of it, to the winery part of it, and to the olive oil and the olive grove as we tended each part of those pretty much on our own.
No, you actually have, we're talking about both the wines that we sampled and the olive oil that you produce. You said your website says you're sold out of this year's.
Yes, it was. We need to, truth be told, it was a quite different growing season with not a lot of fruit on the trees, and the fruit that we had was a very hot summer, so the fruit was already pretty tiny in terms of the olive per se, so the yield was low. It was actually of very good quality, but there just wasn't a lot to go around this year.
We were in the UK and it was so hot, I'd never seen it so bad.
Yeah, we had
it was very droughty. The thing is, it started off not just in the summer. It was something that goes back last year this time when we basically had little or no rain all winter. And you think, well, spring is coming along, it will bring rains, and there was no rain in the spring. Then we think, well, we will pay for it in the summer. It will be rainy, and no rain.
Didn't rain then either. My goodness. Well, I guess the grapes must have done okay. But here's an interesting thing I want you to explain, because we have never before even heard of a wine called Fregino.
Yes.
We've no more heard of that than we have wine called Pottarello.
Pottarello.
And then there's a third one over here called I mean, I won't even begin to pronounce that. But these are all IGT. They're not the DOCG wines that we typically find here in the United States from Italy. So perhaps you can explain, because there's a transition going on right now.
Sure. The Marmocchio is an actual DOC Todi. Todi, we're in Umbria, we're in the Central Valley called the Tiber Valley, and Todi has become a DOC as of probably 5 years ago.
Okay.
So the Marmocchio is now a DOC Todi. The Pottarello, our other wine, will be a DOC Todi with the 2015 vintage that has been bottled recently. The Fregino will remain an IGT. So IGT was the more general denomination for the whole region, and then the local, the more denominated areas, in this case Todi, as you already know, Montefalco next to us, they basically wanted the higher recognition of their territory, and that's how this came about.
Now these
but
are
the names per se. So we all Sangiovese as a base of grapes, especially within the DOC Todi area denomination. But the names, and a part of what we went after here was to be truthfully saturated in the locale, and that goes not just with the grape selection. And, you know, we started off with a certified organic from the get-go, but also with the names, because they have significance really locally. Pottarello, for example, is just in the villages here in Collazzone and Todi and a couple other ones around us that mean little kid or child.
Okay.
So when you call your children, and you talk to your friends, and you say, hey, are you bringing the kids along? You would say in Italian, porti porti, means, are you bringing the kids? And that's how Pottarello came about. It's this name that is just pinpointing the locale and the area in which we make this wine. Fregino has a similar, actually very closely related, it's probably used a little more widely in Umbria, but mostly in Perugia, in the bigger city, you would say Frego, but has kind of the same intention, exactly. The same that family Marmocchio is Italian, it's not Umbrian per se as the other two, and it means rascal. Rascally, teenage-y kid. Yeah, so.
Anyway, I don't
use
that word.
Ragazzi, right? Now, here's an interesting blending grape called Malvasia Nera. Now, I think
that's
of
right.
Malvasia as a white wine that has this kind of a sweetie edge, but Malvasia Nera must be different. Presumably it's probably red.
It is red. It's probably just as finicky as the white cousin it has. But again, going back to wanting to bring maybe back something that had been and no longer was, going back in time, our denomination and Umbria in general probably came into the quality winemaking later on, definitely after Tuscany, which is definitely has become much more well known, and it's definitely more on the wine map, more so than Umbria. But here it was more of a farming environment, and people would farm these vines and grapes and turn them into the local co-ops, and you know the co-ops would decide, okay, this year we're really doing well with whites, just bring in the whites, and the farmers would, you know, change their crop to just have whites, and it was never really cared for about what was there before, many years ago. So Malvasia Nera and Colorino are classic grapes from central Italy that have kind of gotten forgotten. Uh-huh. Colorino, for example, was also blending grape in Chianti, and that was supplanted by other varietals, most notably Mermelot. So for us, it was a way to bring those back into the winemaking.
Now, how did you learn your winemaking? You obviously know a lot about it. I mean, how did that happen? Was that another of your little detours in life?
It was. You know what, Peter? It was a true crash course. And
okay.
Obviously, there was great dedication and curiosity, and just putting yourself out there and wanting to learn, and also taking the fact that there will be mistakes and try to learn from them. But also what I really learned, I think, during this whole process, that it takes a lot of just diligence and doing the things at the right time, more so than this scientific knowledge above it. There is some of that, but it's really just being with it and getting to learn and to understand when certain things need to be done and when they shouldn't be done. And when they need to be done, to actually have the willingness to do them, you know. And sometimes it's a lot of manual labor with it. Being in the sustainable and especially in the organic farming and some other operations that we do in our vineyards, it means that if it's time to take a hoe and weed out the weeds by hand, we have to do it. You know, there's no way around it. So it's a lot of that stuff. More so than this, the school knowledge that would be as a base.
Well, I think we should talk about availability. Not everyone is as fortunate to be your friend as we are. but I'm guessing you are sending some of your product to the United States, because you said you're going to be coming over here shortly. Where are people going to be able to find it? Is there a store locator on your website or anything like that?
We're importing into Massachusetts,
okay,
which is also our home away from home. That's the first state we went into, and we've been there for several years. We're working actually very actively right now, trying to be present in different other states. So that's a work in progress, and we'll update our website accordingly as we are more available. You can certainly order wine through our website, but from a store perspective, from a restaurant perspective, it's the greater Boston area, Massachusetts, and hopefully within not before too long we'll be also in Pennsylvania as well.
Good. The website is?
It's www.lasegreta.com. You'll find there's a section for our wines. There's also a section for our olive oil, and obviously there's a section for our farmhouse, for the hospitality portion of it as well.
Great. Well, don't be surprised if sometime next year we come knocking on your door.
We'll be delighted.
But I guess we'll have to call for directions at the very least. Anyway.
Yeah. You do. So far, of all the people who have come and visited us, we haven't lost anyone yet. So I'm.
Now, what is your logo with this? It looks like a moon and three stars.
It's a moon and three stars. We grew fond of it, but it wasn't something that was premeditated. Mm-hmm. It was a logo. We had a very good designer. His name is Frank Viva in Toronto. And we've been friends ever since. He came a few times to stay with us, and he threw a couple of ideas at us. And it goes with this. I think what it really needed to express was this quiet and relaxing,
yes,
and comfortable environment. And I think that's what it was about. And that's what it gave to us. And that's why we liked it so much. But we didn't come up, it needs to signify something particular in our lives or anything.
Okay, sweetheart, what do we say? Buona Natale?
What?
Buona Natale. Merry Christmas, right?
Oh, Buon Natale.
Buon Natale, there we go. I was trying. Right. I was trying. I now expanded my Italian vocabulary to at least 12 words. And here's wishing you a happy holiday or wherever you are. And we'll see you again same time, same place next week. Until then.
Bye-bye.